The last time I talked to my next guest, he was on a TV show with Regis Philbin. No, not the morning show, but a Fox Sports 1 sports show, and he and Regis were both on the same panel, which led to some interesting conversations. He is also the only person I know who has ever recommended that you and I more often throw a 2-pound bag of flour against a wall to relieve stress. He makes that suggestion in his new book, Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living. Jason Gay, the Wall Street Journal columnist, is here. Hi, Jason. How are you?
Hey, thanks so much. And, you know, just let me get it out of the way. Have you ever thrown a 2-pound bag of flour against the wall?
No, I have not.
Oh, it is a stress reliever like no other stress reliever. You know, there are people who like to have a cocktail. There are people who prefer a massage. But I'm telling you, a big 2-pound bag of flour, you throw that thing against a brick wall, it's like the stress never happens.
As long as you don't have to clean it up.
That's right. You need to make sure that it's an outdoor wall and a rainstorm is coming.
Otherwise, you're just creating stress for somebody else.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I want to touch on various stories that you tell here in the book, and then also talk about some sports stuff, since that's what you write about for the Wall Street Journal. But I'm really curious about this portion of the book where you write about the late Robin Williams. We have recently heard revelations from his wife about this Dewey body dementia that he suffered from,
much more than
depression. But you had a chance to talk to him and really got into one of his passions, didn't you?
Yes, I did. You know, this was going back, I guess, now 6 or 7 years ago, and I was interviewing Robin Williams for a comedy special he was doing. And, you know, these guys do so many interviews for, you know, specials like that. And you know, I don't want to say he was on autopilot, but I wasn't asking him anything he hadn't been asked 100 times before. But I knew, I had read somewhere that Robin Williams was passionate about cycling. And so at the end of the interview about the comedy special, I started to ask him about bikes. And it was as if a light had just flickered above his head. And all of a sudden he came to life in a way that, you know, he hadn't been able to with his comedy special. And he just talked with great passion about what cycling meant to him. He had this spectacular bike collection. I think it's fair to say, you know, how Jay Leno collects all these crazy exotic cars. Robin Williams pretty much did that with bicycles for most of his life. And, you know, he just loved it. And he said something toward the end of the interview. And I know that there's been some conversation about the circumstances of Robin Williams' final days and weeks, but, you know, he did struggle by his own admission with depression. And he said that, you know, what he loved about cycling, what he loved about riding a bike, was that it was the closest that he ever would feel to flying. And as someone who has ridden a bike for most of my life, and as someone who has, you know, used it as therapy, I related to that feeling so much. And I wrote about this in a story for the Journal, and I was astonished by how many people from every imaginable walk of life wrote to say, I relate to that feeling exactly. And, you know, it sort of speaks to a broader thing in Little Victories, which is to try to find those things, those moments in life, and they don't have to be extraordinary things. They can be something as simple as just wandering out the door and going for a bike ride that give you that feeling, that give you that momentary satisfaction and happiness, because those are just, that's really what it's all about.
I was one of those who could relate to that tremendously, because I rode a bicycle everywhere when I was a kid and into my teen years until I got a car. You know, I mean, literally everywhere. Whenever I went to a friend's house or anywhere in town, I was on a bike. And then I didn't ride it for probably 30 or more years until I became a dad and then had to teach my daughter how to ride a bike.
Yeah.
And I remembered how much I enjoyed that and how much I loved every moment on it. And now she's off at college and I can't play tennis anymore because I blew out my knee. So I got back on the bike and I remembered that wind in your face feeling like you're flying.
Yeah.
It's a perfect description.
And you know what? The bicycle, you know, it's a perfect invention. You know, the technology, you know, has gotten better and things are lighter and more expensive, of course, but it's basically the same darn thing it's been for decades upon decades. And the sensation is extraordinary. And, you know, I find with modern life especially, you know, we all find ourselves so consumed with the hustle and bustle of modern life. And, you know, enough has been said about how ridiculously attached we've become to technology, in particular our little smartphones. when I'm on a bike, I can't think of anything but the bike. You know, it's just, it's a liberating thing. I'm thinking about the road in front of me. I'm feeling that wind across my face, like you mentioned, and I'm in the moment. And I feel like we construct these sort of strange realities around ourselves nowadays where we're so obsessed with what's happening elsewhere, what's happening down the road, that we don't really live in the moment. And a bike, you're instantly in the moment, and that's what makes it such a beautiful experience, I think.
Yeah. This theme of kind of relaxing or enjoying the moment runs through your book, not just from the bag of flour to riding a bike, but even in coaching a Little League baseball team, where you essentially wanted to tell all the kids, look, we're not going to win. We're just going to come and have fun if we can, right?
Yeah, well, listen, the chapter you mentioned is a piece in there, and this is a book that's, you know, trying to reach out to people who aren't sports fans and maybe don't care at all about sports. It's a book for everybody, but this is a chapter about youth sports. And, you know, all of us have seen these crazy stories in the newspaper about, you know, parents screaming at referees and tackling each other in the parking lot outside of hockey rinks. And we've just created this climate around kids sports, which is just ridiculous. And, you know, as somebody who's in the business of covering professional sports, I have to tell you, you get a real good look at the odds of professional sports, and you get a real appreciation for how exceptional, how rare it is that you're ever going to get to the point where someone's paying you to do this. And the rest of it are games. They really are. And there are bigger games and smaller games, and I'm not trying to say someone who's playing big-time college football is doing the same thing as someone playing touch football in the backyard. But we need to keep an appreciation for just what it means to play sports, and it's supposed to be fundamentally for exercise. Hopefully you pick up some lessons along the way about cooperation and teamwork and sacrifice, but it's supposed to make us happy. And so this letter in this book to my future Little League team, quote-unquote, the Zen Cubs, it's meant to sort of underline that. I want these kids to go out there. I want them to have fun. If they learn to become great baseball players, great. If they don't, that's fine too. If they just want to stand in the outfield and daydream, daydream away. I'm not going to get preoccupied with turning everybody into a Major League All-Star because I've seen the tables. That's not going to happen.
You realize you hurt yourself in book sales in St. Louis by calling the Little League team the Cubs.
Oh, well, you know what? They're an unsatisfactory playing Little League team, so there you go.
So the select team would be the Cardinals. The Zen
That's
team
right.
would be the Cubs.
The travel team, okay, would be the Cardinals. And let's face it, you know, you guys are cranking out the great baseball for a long time there, so you don't really need any baseball lessons from me.
No, that's probably true. Talking with Jason Gay, the Wall Street Journal sports columnist, who's got a new book called Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living. Jason, you bookend the book with stories of your dad and his death and how it affected you. And I wonder, because you became a dad shortly before you lost your own dad, how that time of your life kind of caused you to think forward about these new children that were entering your life in relation to the man who was leaving his.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's a great question. I started this book before my dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer. I got well underway with it. And, you know, it really began as a humor book. You know, I wanted to write an imperfect advice book for people who can't stand advice books.
Yeah.
But along the way, my dad got sick and, you know, his life really began and became his whole, you know, world became about these little victories, you know, small everyday things that we might have taken for granted in the past, whether it was having a conversation with dad or taking the grandchildren to see him or going for a walk around the block when he had strength to walk around the block. Those things we took for granted before, but they became so incredibly lucid and important and meaningful, and we savored every last second of them. And it really sort of underlined for me that, you know, amid all the humor about this book and amid all the sort of silliness of Little Victories, that there's a real message that I believe in because I saw it firsthand with my dad.
And did the fact that you had kids after quite a struggle, by the way, with in vitro fertilization, and you go into that in depth in the book as well, did that change your perspective on other parents?
Yeah, of course. You know, and you know, I think, as you mentioned, you know, we had a hard time having kids, and a lot of people have a hard time having kids. And there were days and weeks and maybe a year or two in there where we really doubted it was going to happen. And we got very lucky, and, you know, I absolutely, going through what we went through with my dad has made me have a newfound appreciation for my own children. I do get a little melancholy sometimes, you know, when I think about my dad as it relates to my kids, because, you know, every once in a while, your kid will ask you a question. And my dad was a high school science teacher for 40 years, and, you know, my kid will say to me, you know, I'm pointing out a star in the sky, and I'll say, well, that star is part of the Big Dipper, and that goes like this, and my little boy, my three-year-old, will look at me and say, why?
Yep.
And I'm like, man, I don't know why, but you know what? My dad would know why. My dad would know exactly why. That's what he cared about. That's what he was passionate about. And so when you sort of, like, feel that little empty moment for a minute, it still hits you. And I've learned to, like, it makes me sad in the moment, but it also makes my dad feel like a vital human being to me still. He doesn't feel like someone who's in the past. He still feels like someone with me. And, you know, that's a little victory, too.
Very well said. There's another chapter of the book, or section of the book, and it's a funny book, by the way. I don't want anybody to think that it's all maudlin, even though we're touching on a couple of serious topics here. But there is another part of the book that really touched me, and that is the story of your trip to Africa with a guy named Marty. I'm not going to ask you to tell the whole story here, obviously, but just lay out the basics for my listeners.
Yeah, I mean, this is a funny story because he was, you know, probably the most, he had the most extraordinary life change of anyone I've ever been around. This guy was a 40-year-old mortgage broker from Minneapolis. He was adopted at childbirth. Like a lot of people who are adopted, started to take an interest in, where did I come from? You know, he was getting older. He wanted to find out who his birth parents were. He found out that his parents had met in college. His mother was a woman who was going to a college in Iowa, and his father was a visiting student from Nigeria. And this was the 1960s, early 1960s. It was awfully hard to sort of track these folks down, but it took him a couple of years. He found out that his father was still alive, was living in a remote village in southeastern Nigeria. As it turned out, was the king of his principality in Nigeria, which made Marty, this mortgage broker, soccer dad from Minneapolis, his firstborn and therefore the prince and heir of this village in Nigeria. I reached out to him when I read about this little, you know, discovery of his. And I said, if you ever go see your dad, if you ever go, can I come along? And he must have thought I was a lunatic. He didn't know me from a hole in the wall. But several months later, he said, we're going to make it happen, and I'd like you to come. And I came along with him on this trip. And, you know, I will never forget it as long as I live. I mean, forget about the fact that we were in this incredible place and traveling across the world to see someone look their father in their eyes for the first time, and a person that they never thought they would ever get the opportunity to miss and see that, to look that person in the eye, is the essence of who we are as people. It was an incredible trip, and I was thrilled to be able to tell in this book.
Yeah, there's quite a story. It's in the book, Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living, by my guest, Jason Gay, who's a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Let's get back to sports here for just a moment, if we can. Here in St. Louis, there's a big push on for a new NFL stadium along the Mississippi River, an attempt by the region to try to hold on to the Rams. Frankly, I wouldn't care if the dome hit them in the butt on the way out on their way to Los Angeles after four winning seasons out of 20, although they're looking a little bit better this year. What are your thoughts on towns versus teams when it comes to the new stadiums?
Well, listen, I think the mentality has changed a little bit in recent years when we've looked at the economic studies and in particular sort of the long-term impact of creating new stadiums, especially when they're subsidized stadiums, and whether or not they're actually worth the money people are laying out for them. I don't dispute for one second the civic pride that can come from a franchise. I mean, look at how much St. Louis is attached to the Cardinals. Think of how meaningful Cardinals baseball is to St. Louis and far beyond. But, you know, I think people are getting smarter about what they're willing to lay out. My question about the actual particulars about what's happening in St. Louis as it relates to Los Angeles is, look, we've had you know, what is it, close to 20-odd years now of Los Angeles without a football team, I don't really hear Los Angeles agitating for a football team. There seems to be this abstract idea that it's a big American city and thus absolutely has to have a football team. It just seems like more of the same in terms of, you know, overpromising and people chasing the best possible deal. And the shame of it is, of course, alienating people who really do care passionately about a sport.
Yeah, and of course, Los Angeles didn't support football in the first place, which is how we got the Rams.
That's right. I mean, the Oakland moved to L.A. and then scrambled back to Oakland. The Rams, of course, led L.A. for St. Louis. There's a track record there, and it's not looking so hot.
Yeah. While we're on the NFL, I'm curious what you think of Greg Hardy, the guy who's a domestic abuser, who essentially got out of going to jail because the woman who he had beaten up took a payoff to not testify against him. And then he ends up on the Dallas Cowboys because Jerry Jones apparently has less morality than I thought anybody did.
Well, listen, the Dallas Cowboys have we talk about a track record. They have a thorough track record of making bad signings because the man in charge thinks it's a good idea. And I think Greg Hardy is probably the number one example now in Cowboy history of, you know, an owner thinking like he just was the smartest guy in the room and was making a decision that would benefit his football team. And we've seen in the last couple of weeks that it's been absolutely anything but. This controversy, these facts, this detail about what Greg Hardy was accused of, these photographs that have come out, you know, the heart of this matter, this was all available to Jerry Jones. This was all available to the Cowboys. That NFL, the NFL, you know, we gave Roger Goodell a hard time with the Ray Rice matter. They did give him a 10-game suspension on the basis of their own investigation. This is simply what the Cowboys figured they could get through, not getting through, and they deserve all the criticism they get. And you know what? I hate to be crass about this. You know, I hate to be as tacky as to suggest that it's all about what happens on the field. Nothing's happening on the field either. The Cowboys are looking at, you know, a top draft pick right now because they're one of the crummiest teams in football.
Yeah. And by the way, I also detest the fact that Greg Hardy, while he may be a talented player, is being called a leader. A guy like this, you can never, I don't want anybody looking up to this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a very, very strange time that we're living in, and I think that it's important to give a dose of perspective here. That, you know, I think that it's great that we care about sports. There's a lot to love about them, and I get as passionate and crazy shouting at my television like anybody else, but it's not a feast of role models oftentimes, and it's not a place that's indicative of ordinary human social behavior oftentimes. You know, there's a lot about sports which is, you know, this is not something to base one's life around. And I think we see it from time to time repeated. It's just because we are so obsessed now and they've become such multi-billion-dollar entertainment enterprises that we attach so much meaning and importance to them when there's no real importance to it in the first place.
Which brings me to the last thing I want to ask you about, which is daily fantasy sports. And just a little caveat here, I have to tread carefully because my brother, Seth Harris, has effectively been named the commissioner of fantasy sports as the head of this new fantasy sports control agency that the industry has set up in an attempt, I think, to deflect regulation by lawmakers here. But we recently have seen the Attorney General of the state of New York say, no, DraftKings and FanDuel, what you're doing is illegal gambling. The state of Nevada has banned fantasy sports in that state. Ironic that of all the states in America, the first one would be the most lenient when it comes to gambling, Nevada. Where do you think we're headed with this?
Well, I think we're headed towards increased regulation at the very least, and I think you'll see other states follow New York's lead. Just as an aside, I don't mind fantasy sports just personally because right now I have Todd Gurley on my fantasy team, and so things are going pretty well with Jason's fantasy team right now.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I mean, this DraftKings FanDuel thing just kind of seemed to sneak up on people. I know fantasy sports have been around for quite a long time, but when you see the spending that these companies are doing, it's rather extraordinary how big they've become. They have relationships with virtually all of our major sports leagues now. And what I think is really telling, and I think is really important to recognize here, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the government always hopping in to regulate everything immediately, but you have an imbalance within these fantasy leagues where you have, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, sharks, paid professionals, people who are studying algorithms, people who are working with really, you know, trading floors of people who are studying rosters and injury reports and betting every imaginable combination. They're going after the little guy. You watch those commercials on TV. There's a guy coming on in baggy jeans and a sweatshirt acting like, you know, he spent $13 and all of a sudden he's got $500,000. What they're not telling you in that commercial is you're up against a tank full of real sharks who know exactly what they're doing and who really have the balance tipped against them. And this is not just my opinion. This is the opinion of the people who are actually doing this for a living. The Journal ran a really good story a couple weeks back, first-person account of somebody who's in the fantasy gaming business saying, like, man, the odds are tilted against you. If you're just a regular guy on the street just picking teams because you're picking teams, you almost have no chance. And so that starts to veer into the area of, you know, taking advantage of people. And I think that's why the government's taking a real interest.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me a lot of online poker. And I say that as a poker player who has friends who played online. But it always seemed to me, first of all, you could go into a cheating scandal like what happened with Ultimate Bet. Or you could run into a situation where you have a lot of sharks trying to eat up all the rest of the fish. And eventually, you know, the pond gets polluted. And I think that's a lot of what's happening with DraftKings and FanDuel and some of the other sports.
Absolutely. And I think that it speaks again to just the disproportionate, you know, power sports have over our lives where, you know, I don't know what the exact figures are, where we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising spent by both these companies trying to grab mindshare. They have the leagues under their thumb because they're in partnership with them. There's real power there. And you've seen commissioners in several sports say, you know, I'm not really willing to come out completely against it yet. For this very reason, there's so much money on the line. And so, again, that's probably a place where the government's going to take notice. And, you know, I think that these games are going to look a little different in the short term.
On the other hand, it gives me stuff to talk about and you stuff to write about. So what's bad?
You know what? Fantasy football, to me, you know, I got into it this year. I'm enjoying it again. Thank you, Todd Gurley. You're really doing it for me. But there is nothing more boring than hearing somebody else talk about their fantasy team. You know, like, if you find yourself at a dinner and someone started telling you about their fantasy team or heaven forbid, their other fantasy team, I suggest running to the other side of the room because there is nothing duller than that.
Jason Gay is the sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal and the author of the new book, Little Victories, Perfect Rules for Imperfect Living. Jason, a pleasure talking to you again. Thanks for your time.
I really appreciate that. Thank you. Bye-bye.